Science Faction is intended only for adults and children who ask a stranger in front of a liquor store to download it for them.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 226, Science Faction Bioinformatics.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't...
You're probably wrong.
Isn't that the underlying science behind Scientology?
Bioinformatics?
Yeah, like that sounds like a fake science. That sounds like something Scientologists would promote. Bioinformatics.
They have e-meters and they have auditing. I don't know.
Thetans?
Thetans. It's probably a Thetan-based thing. I've been obviously looking at different sciences to cover, and there's the easy ones. We can talk about physics and biology. We've talked about archaeology. But I asked our guest host for a few suggestions, and this one came up. And I got to say, bioinformatics, not something I'm particularly well-versed in. My knowledge mainly comes from Wikipedia. From what it tells me, it's an interdisciplinary field that develops methods and software tools for understanding biological data. That seems pretty broad, but Ian, you're here to clarify this a little bit. What's bioinformatics?
So I like to think of bioinformatics as basically the blending of computer science, programming, and biology. You're using computers to understand, study, analyze biological data, such as your DNA, proteins, that type of thing.
Okay. So is this just the computer interface with this type of stuff? What would you qualify the whole overlying idea of bioinformatics as being?
There's some wiggle room in terms of what's bioinformatics versus what's sort of computational biology. Some people call them the same things. Some people say computational biology is more when you're using the tools to do biology, whereas bioinformatics is more the development of those tools.
Okay. I think I'm getting a little bit of that. Now, does that mean that the science itself is studying the effectiveness of the different methods, or is it just compiling all these different ideas together?
I would say it's a bit of both. You know, it's hard to compile these ideas together without studying which idea is better than another one. A lot of it, especially a lot of the early work, was development of algorithms to efficiently compare two strands of DNA.
Okay.
So if you think of, you know, the human genome, we're trying to compare 3 billion letters to another 3 billion letters. And how do you do that in an efficient manner?
Right. And usually you just sample, right? You take specific spots. You're not going to compare all of those.
No, it depends on what your study is. Especially with the advent of next generation sequencing, or NGS, doing whole genome studies is becoming much more common. There's a really cool program that the NIH is funding called All of Us.
Okay.
And it's something that your listeners can actually sign up for. And it's a NIH program in which they're trying to get 1 million genomes sequenced from the entire human population. There's a lot of other things that go with it, such as you can include fitness data from your, you know, tracker. You can give them some of your medical records if you want. And they're getting
semen samples.
So you always suggest that.
I mail them out every week to random addresses, but if I can benefit science, maybe I'll just mail them to
all of us. That could be one way to get your DNA samples. It's only half of your genome, though, so it's not quite as useful. And the idea is that the more data we have on the genomic side, on the health data side, the better we're going to be able to make predictions and better treatments, especially for personalized medicine and precision medicine.
So this is kind of going down that roadway of each individual treatment will be tailored to the individual person. So instead of, you know, there's this idea that in 50 years, you're not going to go and get a prescription for ibuprofen or something. They're going to give you a prescription that's geared towards your own particular biochemistry, because you happen to have just a little bit higher levels of metabolism and you have some problems with these certain chemicals. And so everything will be geared toward you specifically.
Yep, that's exactly right.
Interesting. So this is kind of a stepping stone to that personalized medicine field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Very interesting. And I would imagine most of this is lab work type stuff. This is there's very few field work bioinformation people, so to speak.
So it kind of depends on how you classify it. Bioinformatics being more of the actual, what I would call dry lab. Mm-hmm. So on a computer, developing algorithms, somebody's already done
it's,
the
it's
sequencing.
Actually, it's a Mormon lab. They're not allowed to bring booze into the lab.
Exactly. What's the underwear about?
Well, if you wear a long enough lab coat, you don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, well, that's a magic lab coat.
And then there are field bioinformatic people who go out and collect the genomes from those who don't want their genome to be collected.
Yes, that's right. They hold them down.
There is a little bit of that happens, yes.
Very interesting, and that's it's one of those fields that, along with things like molecular and cellular biology and stuff, it always seems like that's a place where jobs are going to go. You know, if people are going into the sciences because they want a good career and they're interested in science in general and they just want a nice paycheck and a good lab job, I always say, like, look towards molecular biology. Look in those areas, because those are where you're going to be making some cash later on.
Yeah, and the nice thing about bioinformatics is because it is sort of a blending of these two fields, biology and computer science, you get a lot more sort of cross skills developed. So you would learn how to program, you'd learn how to develop, you know, Java code, Python code,
etc. Now, are there nerd fights within bioinformatics where you have the supercomputer people talking to the super biology people and they get into some kind of what I would imagine is a slapping fight between one another?
A little bit, yeah. Okay. There tends to be a lot more collaboration, but you do have, you know, the biologists who don't trust what the bioinformaticians are saying, and the bioinformaticians who say, no, we know better because this is what our algorithms say, and the biologists call bullshit on that.
You know what this reminds me of, Damien? This is basically a cop drama where you have the biologists who are the old school detectives who just use their street smarts and their cop instincts, and they go out there and they solve crimes. And all of a sudden, this plucky up-and-comer is going to come with all this crime data. He's going to show you where you're spiking in homicides versus robberies and tell you where you need to focus your efforts. And he doesn't want to deal with him because he's too old for this shit.
Jonah Hill with glasses is going to tell me the future of biology? I don't think so. Are you guys all live in fear of the biorobotics guys with their robot arms? And
you mean like the cyborgs?
And laser eyes? Yeah,
yes, he's talking about the cyborgs that are, of course, working in your lab.
I mean, we do have robots in the lab, but they tend to be pure robots. But they can be a little scary. They have a really tight grip.
Okay, so we're not to the point yet where I can get my laser eye. Understood. I'm going to check out for the rest of the episode then.
And speaking of laser eyes, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. And with me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damien Mercado. Damien, how you doing this afternoon?
Doing great. Although, I don't think I'd want laser eyes.
I mean, they seem like they'd be useful.
Well, in what way? That I could, that I could incinerate somebody that I'm looking at?
Like, yeah.
I mean, I don't trust myself with a firearm. You're going to give me laser eyes?
How many times have you been like arms full of groceries? You have to get through the door. You don't want to get your keys out. How much easier would it be to laser beam your way through the door and you don't have to worry about putting all the groceries down?
You're right, and I suppose nobody will break into my home either, so
that's
I won't worry about that because I'm a laser eye.
Laser eyes, right? So you don't get broken in there. And our scientist for the evening, Ian. Ian, how you doing?
Not too bad.
Good to have you back. We haven't had you in a bit.
Yeah, it's been a little while.
And of course, if you want to get back with us, you can check out our website, www.thesciencefaction.com, where we'll have the links to all the articles we cover, as well as some we don't get to. And if you want to catch me live in person, I have two big shows coming up in San Diego. One is at the Reuben H. Fleet for our Star Wars Han Solo night. If you want to come on in there, you can get tickets through reubenhfleet.com. That will be for our Han Solo sneak peek screening. We're actually showing the new Han Solo movie before anyone else gets to see it. You can come see it. You can also be part of a large event that we're holding at the Reuben H. Fleet where you can come on in. There's a costume contest. I'm going to be doing Star Wars-based stand-up in that big dome theater. It's going to be a really fun night. Tickets are super affordable given the fact that you get to see that movie before anybody else. And then you can do that thing where you walk along the line of all the people who have waited 18 hours in line to go see the new movie and give away the ending, which is always a fun one to do.
You're going to do your stand-up set dressed as Data, aren't you?
Yeah, just to piss everybody off. Yes, and then also you can catch me at Nerd Night in San Diego at 32 North Brewery. That'll be on June 5th. I will be doing an entire multimedia stand-up set based around a museum exhibit I'm developing with the Reuben H. Fleet called The Science of Funny. So we'll get into all the science that is behind what is and is not funny. That will also be very interesting. So again, May 24th and June 5th, come on out and see me perform some interesting novel stand-up.
Oh, and if you guys have any ungoogleable questions, we are still searching for an excellent ungoogleable question. If you think you got something that Bobby can answer that nobody else can, please, we're looking for some fan interaction.
We've had some good ones so far. Very excited about this new bit. Please give us some more fodder because love this bit.
Also, if you find yourself bored sometime after listening to this episode, why don't you go down and give us a 5-star rating and leave us a comment on iTunes. I just come in and I make the dick jokes. I do the ha-has. But Bobby has not enjoyed a Saturday in over 5 years.
No.
Spends countless hours editing. He doesn't ask for anything in return except for your firstborn child and a 5-star review and comment on iTunes. So
right.
Please...
And if you got one, give me a good bioinformatics joke, because I wasn't able to get one earlier. All right, guys, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
Okay, guys, article number one, HIV's cousin is causing some problems.
It's HPV.
No, right. It is not. It's not actually HPV. That's actually
it's HIV sluttier cousin.
Here's the deal. I had not even realized the existence of this particular virus we're about to talk about until I read this, which I have to say is pretty surprising for me. I usually know these weird esoteric science things. I read on average 80 to 120 science articles per week. It is very rare that something of this magnitude slips my view, and this did. So I'm imagining it probably slipped a lot of yours too. That makes it interesting to me. This particular virus is called HTLV. It is considered a cousin of HIV by some people because we also got it seemingly from apes. There's a few different varieties. There's HTLV 1 through 4. And the problem with this particular virus is, after you get infected, depending on which one of the viruses you get, you have between a 1 in 20 and 1 in 25 chance of developing cancer because of the virus. So the virus essentially causes you to develop a cancer. We see this with HPV, actually. Like you said before, we see that developing cervical and throat cancers. This would be something similar, only it has you develop a leukemia blood cancer, which is quite bad for you. It can also cause some other neurological issues, even if you don't develop the cancer.
So one thing that I wasn't able to find any information on it was whether this is related to feline leukemia virus, which I know is relatively common in cats.
Interesting, because there's also feline AIDS. There's cat AIDS. Mm-hmm. That's also super common in cats. A lot of cats have AIDS. So that's a good question. I wonder if it would be, because this causes that leukemia, this is a viral infection. I wonder if it's our primate version of that, the same way we have primate HIV.
And one of the nice things about that is there is a vaccine for FLV. And yes. So hopefully that if they are related, then we could more easily develop a vaccine for this.
I think there's one for feline. Yeah, there's one for feline HIV as well, but there's still one for human HIV. So
fuck your cat with impunity.
Yeah, feline, that's right.
We got a vaccine for feline HIV. Quick question.
Uh-huh.
How does a virus increase your chances of getting cancer? Does the virus just use a lot of microwaves when it's inside you?
That's
is it
does.
Mining uranium?
Yeah, the virus is exposing you to a lot of radiation you wouldn't otherwise be exposed to.
No, but really, how does
it, you can? There's a lot of different mechanisms by which out of control cell growth can start as a result of a viral infection. So, like I said, we've seen this with HPV. That's the best example, where basically almost 100% of cervical cancer and a lot of throat cancers are caused by HPV infection of both of those areas.
So, be a less generous lover.
Yes, absolutely. That Michael Douglas learned that the hard way. I'm actually not particularly sure what the exact biomechanism is on this one, but we do know that it happens with viral infections.
Again, I don't know if it's in this case particular. In other viruses, what'll happen is the virus will insert its genome into the host cell's genome. And if it happens to insert it into a place that disrupts some sort of signaling mechanism, causes that cell to start growing uncontrollably, that's generally what happens.
So in the same way that ultraviolet radiation can harm you from the sun and cause cancer by knocking out the specific part of the genes in a single cell that regulate that cancer growth, this is doing the same thing, only it's manually done by the virus inserting a segment into your genome.
Exactly.
Okay.
If I'm a young cell and a virus comes offering me genes, I just need to say no.
Just say no.
But right now, this is swamping central Australia. And those of you guys who know anything about Australia know that the middle of Australia is very low population.
Because it's upside down. Everybody just keeps falling off.
I thought it was flat.
It's mainly Aboriginal groups, and it is widespread through there. Some communities have as much of a 40% infection rate, which would be a huge then cancer rate that follows. And again, remember, we're not just talking about that possibility of cancer. There's also long-term neurological issues that can arise from this, as well as other immune issues that can happen. This virus seems kind of mysterious. I mean, we have seen evidence of it in Andean mummies, 1400 BC, around there, meaning that this has been around within the human population for some time. We have it endemic in different places that seem really far spread, places like parts of the Caribbean, South America, including Brazil, Peru, Colombia, and French Guiana, some tropical areas of Africa like Gabon, some areas in the Middle East like parts of Iran, one little spot in Romania, and a super rare little place in Melanesia. So really widespread in terms of where it is. But because of the association with primates and where it comes from, we know it originally came from some kind of great apes, which is interesting because Andean mummies, that's South America. If you look at the occupation of the New World, we're talking about a group that was genetically isolated from the rest of the population for at least 20 some odd thousand years ago, which means it has to be old enough to have come across with those people who came into the New World 20,000 years ago, which means this has been around with human beings for a long time. We're not talking about HIV, which we can trace the individual who got it back to the early 1900s. We're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of years.
That's you've missed science articles for that
long? Yeah, that's right. I got to read back up.
That's actually not that uncommon for a lot of viruses, though. I mean, if you look at the, you know, going back to bioinformatics.
Sure.
If you look at the human genome, there's actually lots of history of old genetic viruses in our genomes that are just there. And
sure, but there's also more examples, I would say, of viruses that, for instance, didn't exist in the New World. I mean, that's what killed everybody when we got to the New World is all these diseases from the Old World came in that they were not exposed to. This would be the opposite. This would be something that's so ancient, it's as ingrained in them as it would be in us when we came over. Super, super interesting. We didn't discover it until 1980. So while it's been around with us for a long time, we kind of started seeing it at that same point where you see a lot of viruses start getting discovered with that technology boost in the mid to late 70s, where we could start doing more viral research. We discovered it at that point. Now, this can obviously be lethal because people die of cancer. They die of the neurological issues. It certainly can take a huge toll on lifespan, overall lifespan, and life quality. So it's a pretty big deal. Right now, there's only one group, the Japanese, and there is some endemic areas of Japan that have an infection area. The Japanese have a partial vaccine and some treatment drugs that they are using for it, but nobody else has it, and everybody, including people infected in the U.S., have not been able to get Japan to give them those drugs, so...
We are more than willing to share drug, but it is,
That was very Russian.
Everything goes Russian.
We Japanese scientists are very willing to share drug, but nobody wants to take drug that is administered through tentacle penis.
It's a very, very interesting story in terms of human migration, where this came from, how long it's been with us, who knows how long, maybe 70, 80,000 years if you're talking about an exodus from Africa. Some of these places, if you're going to say, how does it get to Brazil and Peru and modern day places, you can see that coming from the slave trade. You could see there being an endemic population in Africa. They get moved. Most of the slaves that came over from Africa ended up in South America. It would very likely be a reason for those to be more modern. But the ancient Andean mummies, that cannot be explained that way. So I think a lot of this is probably a very ancient movement of people and not necessarily a modern one.
Unless, of course, somebody decided to go and get busy with an Andean mummy.
Like, you mean now? Like, they now just decided to go bang a mummy? Okay, fair enough.
It doesn't have to be now. I mean, there's a thousand years of year window to fuck that mummy.
It can cause lung conditions. There's bronchial diseases it can cause. It hurts the immune system. And what can be done about it is, obviously, we can steal their crazy Japanese drug, which we definitely need to do. I still find it funny. There was, like, a case of some American kid who got it, and he's like, this is crazy. I guess I really need treatment. I better find out where. Oh, it turns out some Japanese scientists have it. Hey, can I use that drug? No, I should just die and fuck myself? All right, okay, thanks. Yeah, just checking in.
So wait, are they sharing it with the Japanese population?
I think in the area, because they have an area where they have an outbreak or they have an endemic situation where this HTLV-1 is very prevalent, and they then have some research that they're using there, but apparently they're not sharing their goods.
Wait, what if they're not sharing with the out rest of the world is because this is what they need, all that whale that they harvest.
It's a whale base.
It's like, yo, if you guys are going to give a shit about the whales, you guys don't get no vaccinations.
It is funny that we don't think of it as a big deal because it's not affecting us. You know, it's not really a big deal in the United States or Europe. We don't see it as a very high prevalence. So because of that, I've never even heard of it. Ian, have you heard of this before this week?
No, just a feline leukemia.
Yeah,
virus.
I've never even heard of it. It's funny how self-centric that is. You know, this is a really bad disease. It's transmitted very much the same way HIV is, sexual contact, breastfeeding, that kind of stuff. It's funny that because it doesn't seem to affect us, we've never even heard of the thing, nor do we care to even research into fixing it.
I mean, again, that was sort of the same thing with the Zika virus until we had sort of the major outbreaks.
Sure.
You know, who had heard of Zika before, you know, 2015?
Yep.
Zika could have been cured, but then it decided to attack Brazil and the world still didn't give a shit, so...
Well, Zika, though, I mean, at least it was, like, contained to, like, tropical Africa and then I think Samoa or something like that. Like, it had a very, very small little area. This seems to be rather widespread. Those places I listed are throughout the globe.
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with mode of transmission.
Yes, yeah, and how long it's been around. You know, Zika is a very quickly moving virus that kind of makes its way through the population, whereas this seems to be very old and has somehow traveled, you know, with humans across the exploration of brand new continents.
Well, and it's actually HTLV has sort of like the perfect combination, because I was reading it can take up to 40 years before symptoms start to develop, which means a person is infected, spreading the disease for 40 years before they die off.
Right. Yeah, those are always the ones, the long-lasting ones, where you are contagious during your period, but you don't know you're infected the longer that period. And this was the deal with HIV in the 80s. The longer that period, I mean, who knows what they were doing 8 years ago? You know, when you, like, where? How did you catch it? I don't know. Everything I've ever done in my life, let's examine it.
Exactly.
It'll also be interesting to see how seriously we take it now that it is becoming a big issue. There's a whole push for the U.S. to start doing research. That's how I became aware of this. There's actually a group out of the University of Maryland, I believe, that is leading this research, and they're just trying to get everybody's attention. They're like, hey, CDC, we're going to wave our hands around until you notice that this is a problem. Hey, international research community, check out this group in Australia that has a 40% infection rate with this very lethal, very damaging virus. Hey, everybody, by the way, if we didn't learn from HIV, this stuff can spread. And the fact that we don't have it now doesn't mean it won't soon be an epidemic here. So maybe we should get ahead of that and get some vaccines and treatments going.
So wait, the CDC officially recognizes arm waving
as a method of... Yeah, yeah, but you have to do it right. It's like when you go scuba diving, there's a specific one that says I'm in danger, you know? But if you don't do the right one, then they'll just let you drown.
Look at that asshole waving.
On to article number two. Mom's coffee makes a fat child. Interesting study comes out of Scandinavia, and it looks at a mother's consumption of caffeine, not just coffee, but caffeine during pregnancy, and then it follows up. It does an 8-year follow-up. It's quite a long longitudinal study in that sense of these people with a huge N number. This is one of the biggest N numbers of a study of this type I've ever seen, more than 50,000 in this particular sample. They looked at these mothers during their pregnancy, how much caffeine consumption they had, and then they followed their children for the next 8 years to see if there was any effect that they can draw. And
the helicopter moms. Every one of them was a helicopter mom.
One thing they noticed was their kids were a little fatter. So there seemed to be a correlation with overweight children or childhood obesity and mothers who had the caffeine. And not just, it wasn't just a binary study. They didn't just say, hey, did you drink caffeine while you were pregnant? Yes, you did. Okay, you're in this category. They measured the amount in the milligrams of how much caffeine you had per day. And the importance of that particular thing is they actually showed a correlation, not just binary, like I did or I did not. The more caffeine you had, the more likely it was that you had an overweight child. So that's very interesting. The large N number is very interesting. The fact that they did that type of study where it wasn't binary, it was done as a gradual or gradated scale, which allows you to tell more things, that is very interesting. However, as we start this, we're going to say what this article and all the ones you'll see do not say, causation correlation. We have to think of the fact that we're not saying that because these moms had caffeine, we know that caused these kids to be fatties. No.
Moms who drink more coffee, they're more likely to make their child dinner instead of just falling asleep when they get home.
Yes. Well, think about it. Here's a few things. One is, what is coffee usually associated with? People who get up and go to work early, people who have things like that that they're going to be doing while they're pregnant. Maybe it's a lower socioeconomic thing. Those moms who are pregnant, they don't get the time off from work when they're pregnant. They have to keep going to work, so they're going to have more coffee. What does that mean? They're not at home when their kids are home growing up later on. They're taken care of by daycare, more likely to eat bad things because their mom's not around. It could be that it's a stress thing, that it has to do with that mom is compensating for a genetic predisposition for stress by taking caffeine. The child's going to do the same thing by eating food. It could be the opposite of the socioeconomic argument. It could be that super busy corporate moms are also less likely to monitor what their kids are eating, and therefore those corporate moms who are drinking a bunch of caffeine before they go to work, even while they're pregnant, are also more likely to have kids who are overweight. There's a lot of different possibilities in terms of correlation and why we could see this wouldn't be a direct effect. It could even be, I mean, quite frankly, here's the deal. If you're pregnant, there's a lot of rules. When my wife was pregnant, there's 1,000 rules. Do you just think like, oh, you can't drink booze? No, you can't have fish. You can't have sushi. You can't have peanut butter. You can't have cold cuts. You can't have soft cheeses. These are like 1,000 things. Some women adhere to that. My wife adhered to it like it was a Bible. She stuck to it. She did really well. I was super proud of her. Some people kind of go, fuck it, I don't care, right? And you'll see it. Some people are drinking beers or something while they're pregnant.
Cigarettes.
Yeah. The more likely you are to dismiss the recommendations, including don't have too much caffeine, the more likely you are to dismiss those recommendations, you're probably also more likely to not give a fuck about whether or not the kid is fat. Like, if you didn't care about him when he was a fetus, you're probably not going to care whether he's overeating when he's a kid.
So in the study, did they look at the amount of caffeine in relation to the maximum recommended? Because you are, when you're pregnant, at least per, you know, the rules I've seen, you are allowed some caffeine.
300 milligrams. And it's not a small amount, because something to keep in mind, you're not supposed to have any alcohol. Those things that say, oh, you can have a glass of wine a day. No. When you're pregnant, actually your maximum allowance of alcohol is something like half a glass of wine per week. It's nothing like a glass a day that they tell you. That actually can cause problems.
What if you saved it all up for like the end of the pregnancy?
And then you just do it as one binge thing. Yeah. But caffeine is different. 300 milligrams is about 3 cups of strong coffee. It's 6 cups of tea. It's kind of where a normal person would cap themselves anyway. Like, I'll drink more than 3 cups of coffee every once in a while, but I understand that that's abnormal. Like, you
start getting the jitters.
Yeah, you can safely coast under it. So they did. That's a good question, because they did. They compared how much they drank, including those that drank under that limit and over. And even those drinking under had an increased risk over those who drank none at all. So even if you drank under the amount that is recommended to be safe, your child still had an increased risk of obesity overall against somebody who did not drink at all.
Could it also be that parents who drink coffee tend to have the energy required to fat shame their children, whereas
No. Remember, the coffee drinking causes fat kids, so you wouldn't have the energy.
Well, as we also know, fat shaming doesn't work.
Okay, there you go. That's how it worked. By the age of 5, the share of children who were overweight or obese was 5% greater in the group whose mothers had the highest caffeine consumption in the study compared to those mothers who had the lowest caffeine consumption. 5% increase is statistically significant. It's not blowing you out of the water. We're not seeing huge, giant numbers. But
poor children.
But just as a reference, that is also the rate of people who end up developing leukemia if they end up having the HTLV-1 virus, right? So we said 1 out of 20, so 5%. So it's significant. This is a level that we consider significant in sciences. And if you're increasing that risk of childhood obesity, we know childhood obesity affects longevity in the long run. It affects a lot of cardiovascular health in the long run. It can do long-term damage, even epigenetically, to the next generation. And therefore, it might be worth saying, hey, we need to skip out on the caffeine altogether for pregnant moms because of this potential risk. Or if you are going to have the caffeine when you're pregnant, be aware of your child's weight as they get older, because you might have predisposed them to be obese later on.
And I know, Bobby, you're somebody who prioritizes public health and if you could do something. But I also know you're a fan of BBW pornography.
Sure.
And so I kind of feel like
I'm really torn here.
You win either way.
Yeah, I mean, either
people are more healthy or B, you get better porn 20 years
from now. Yeah, that's true. That is a very good point. You know, and in fact, everybody forget what I said. Red Bulls? Anyone? I'm going to go hang out at a Lamaze class with a truck full of Monster Energy.
Gives you diabetes.
Yeah.
Well, no, the sugar-free one, but still the one with the caffeine.
All right, super, super interesting. Forget I just said anything. Let's move right on to I Call BS.
I call.
I call.
I call.
I call.
I call.
Ring, ring.
I call BS.
All right, I call BS, the game where I read 4 science news articles. My panelists compete to see which ones are real and which ones are BS, standing for bad science. Ian, are you ready to go get back into the game and start hammering Damien the way he's been beaten literally every time since you've last been here?
No, I won last game.
I don't remember that.
I am ready to start jackhammering Damien.
Yeah!
I'll assume the legs behind the head position.
All right. Article number 1. New research indicates that we get migraines because our ancestors were cold. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is science, but they didn't call them migraines. They called them maize.
God, no, Damien, no! One of these days, I'm going to get an episode without you being able to use the word maize. All right, anyway, Ian.
You have to edit. Do a lot of editing.
I'm going to go science as well.
All right. Article number 2. New research suggests that a good treatment for autoimmune diseases is to simply eat baking soda. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is science, because autoimmune diseases are ineffective on the dead.
Oh, so you eat enough baking soda, you die, your immune system can no longer attack you.
You'd have white teeth, like yeah. You'd have clean poop and bowels.
All right, and Ian.
I'm going to go bad science just because I really hope this isn't true, because this would give a whole lot of ammunition to the whole alkaline water movement.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Article number 3, research trials of a new genital herpes vaccine have gone disastrously bad as 4 of the 10 human test subjects have inadvertently been infected with the herpes virus during the trials. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is science. I don't really have a joke, but I do think it'd be really funny to, like, get this injection.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're presented with the filthy prostitute that you need to sleep with in order to get...
Oh, no, see, I think...
Your money.
I was just saying, like, at least...
Are you volunteering?
Yeah, no, at least the guy who got it from the filthy prostitute had some fun getting those herpes. This other guy just got it from the lab.
Maybe it was a filthy, dirty lab.
Yeah, I got a needle prick and herpes. Thank you. By the way, good luck explaining this to my wife. She's really going to buy the whole... No, I swear, I wasn't cheating on you. I was part of a scientific experiment that went wrong.
But this is the difference between a European study and an American study. Europe's, where they fund the scientists,
right.
High-class herpes-infected prostitutes.
Yeah, way better prostitutes.
They just get somebody off the street here with the university system.
All right, and Ian.
I actually thought I had read that this herpes vaccine was going well, so I'm going to call bad science.
All right, and lastly, article number 4. A rhino butchery site has been located in the Philippines at 700,000 years ago, indicating that hominids were traveling the high seas far longer than previously believed. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science. It does not prove anything of what you just said. It proves how far men will go for an erection medication.
Oh, they're getting a rhino horn. That's what they were doing in the Philippines. Okay. And Ian.
I also think I read about this, and I think this was true, although I don't remember if it was 700,000 years ago, but I'm going to go science.
All right, let's go back and see how you guys did. Follow along at home and see how you did. Article number 1. New research indicates that we get migraines because our ancestors were cold. Both of you guys thought this one was science, and this one is science, and very interesting. So, I didn't realize this, but in Finland, 88% of people have a genetic variation that increases their risk of migraines. Compare that to people in Africa, and that number is about 5%. We actually think that a particular protein, TRPM8, which is one that governs how we respond to cold sensitivity, so it probably ups our threshold for very low temperatures, maybe not necessarily for surviving them, though it could be that too, but certainly for being uncomfortable in them. That particular protein is also one of the things that causes us to have migraines. So the idea is, as people left Africa and they adapted to these cold environments, some of those adaptations were negative, or at least had a negative impact on us overall. This doesn't mean that they were selected to have migraines. Obviously, that would be negative, right? But we just talked last week about the shovel-shaped incisors that Native Americans have, and how for the longest time, everybody wondered, how can this one mutation that only exists in people of the New World, but exists in 100% of New World populations, why is this tooth shape so important? What advantage does it get? And it wasn't until just the last month that we figured out it was actually because the same gene that alters the milk ducts within breast to allow children in the high latitudes to be able to get vitamin D and more milk, that particular gene is altered for that purpose, because all those people that occupied the Americas were stuck in Beringia and the northern latitudes for a long time. It also alters their tooth shape. So it was an incidental altering of tooth shape that was very highly selected for trait from something else. This is similar, very highly selected for trait for being able to stand the cold, only it also happens to cause migraines.
Is it possible that we got this migraine gene when we interbred with Neanderthals?
It actually could be. I know you're trying to say something stupid, but it possibly could have been that.
Oh, is it stupid that Neanderthals all died of extreme head pain?
Yeah.
Is that stupid?
And they had bigger heads, so it's probably more painful. All right, on to article number 2. New research suggests that a good treatment for autoimmune disease is to simply eat baking soda. Damien thinks this is true. Ian thinks this is false, and this one is science. It turns out that the cheap antacid signals mesothelial cells in the spleen to not mount an immune response. So basically, it tells your body to kind of cool it with attacking everything.
Hey, quit mounting my immune response. Get off my immune response.
Bad mesothelial. Bad. So the idea is that these cells signal to the spleen whether or not to mount an immune response. When you digest this particular baking soda, it does has the effect as an antacid of kind of signaling them, hey, food is coming. When you eat food, your body has a reaction where as it knows the food is going through, it tamps down the immune system a little bit so your body is not continually attacking everything in your gut. This is a way to up that response and basically tell the rest of your system, hey, tone down the immune response from 11 down to 7.
So all those alkaline water drinkers actually...
No, probably not. That would not affect this in the same way. It's one of the reasons they advise baking soda in particular. This could be a huge deal because while we have really good drugs for things like rheumatoid arthritis and Crohn's and all that stuff, and they work better than baking soda, so definitely don't stop taking your drugs and start doing baking soda. That's not the deal here. But if you're in the third world and you don't have access to that stuff, baking soda is cheap and available, and this could be a real big difference for those people.
If you have an autoimmune disease, don't you want your immune system to get out some of its energy on like on the food passing? Like, yeah, go get the heavy bag. Go beat up that food. Yes,
that's
beat
called,
up
that's called, ourselves. That's called Crohn's. That's basically what Crohn's disease is. Very, very interesting stuff. Good for all those people who have autoimmune diseases in sub-Saharan Africa. On to article number 3, research trials of a new genital herpes vaccine have gone dangerously bad as 4 out of the 10 human test subjects have inadvertently been infected with the virus during the trials. Damien thinks this is true, Ian thinks this is false, and this one is bad science. As Ian predicted, they are actually going stunningly well. It's a mouse model, or more accurately, a guinea pig model, because they're using guinea pigs.
Slutty guinea pigs.
Slutty, slutty ones. And they're showing very strong promise. So, the problem with herpes is genital herpes infects the actual dermis, the mucous membranes parts of your genitals. Sometimes just not even mucous membranes, just the regular skin part. The virus itself burrows down actually into the nerves, and it's able to hide in the nerves. It's got this like special little hidden mechanism where your body starts fighting it, right? The sore goes away. As it's losing, it goes, oh, fuck, I gotta hide until I can come back and fight another day. And it has this special mechanism whereby it can hide itself inside your nerves and essentially remain invisible to the rest of your immune system. So while your immune system beats that herpes infection every time you get it, part of it is hiding away. And it's like in those old Vietnam War movies where some of the Viet Cong would get into a tunnel and hide themselves and let the American forces go past them. And then they show up right behind them.
It's a gift that keeps on giving.
It is. And right now, it's a lifelong infection.
Which is why I burn out the nerve so they have no place to hide.
Yeah. And so what do you do? And so one of the things they did here is they found a way to alter it so that it couldn't hide. And then you can essentially train your immune system to fight this thing without giving it the ability to permanently be in your body. So you expose it to it. Now, this is a deactivated virus, so it's basically just proteins with the same surface binding sites. You train your immune system to be able to fight it. Then if you happen to get an infection at some point, so then you are exposed to herpes at some point later, your body already knows how to fight it. It doesn't get a chance to get down into the nerve cell, and you're essentially immune. It shows super high, up to 97 to 99% effectiveness at blocking future transmissions through these guinea pig models, which is huge. That's giant. It's essentially almost a complete one. They found that if they do a 3 booster shots thing, it basically makes you completely immune to herpes if you're a guinea pig. Who knows about human trials? Right now, it seems like they have solved the herpes issue in guinea pigs.
Is there a site where Damien can sign up, or is it too late for him?
I mean, you do have guinea pig herpes. Let's not play around here.
Couldn't you solve this as well by inventing a medication that dyes your nerves a different color?
Why would a color matter?
Like kind of like how a moth, if a moth is white,
so it can't hide. It's not hiding. Yeah, I've explained how stuff hides on a molecular level to you, but regardless.
No, I want Ian to explain it to me. I want it to stick.
Like herpes.
Exactly. Ian, kiss me and tell me how this works.
Very interesting stuff. It also, and this is the most interesting part of it to me, doesn't just seem to work as a vaccine, but also a treatment. So they also did follow-up tests where they then took the guinea pigs who already had the herpes, they then gave them the vaccine, their immune systems learned to fight this and were therefore better at it when the disease itself would reemerge from its hiding in the nerves.
Is this limited to just genital herpes, or would it work
right
for
now?
Shingles?
Right now, it's limited to HSV-2, which I think is just the genital herpes, but there's no reason they couldn't do the same with HSV-1, which is oral herpes, and also the other stuff that causes chicken pox and all that. All right, on to article number 4. A rhino butchery site has been located in the Philippines at 700,000 years ago, indicating that hominids were traveling the high seas far longer than previously believed. Damien thinks this is false. Ian thinks this is true. And this one is science! Yet another bashing, just brutal bashing of Damien by our scientists. And Ian's been gone for a long time. He does this every week and he's still bad at it, Ian.
I was King Science last week. You can be King Science this week.
Just Ian, every week he does it and he still can't get good at it.
Practice does not make perfect, apparently.
No.
No, he's pretty good at receiving the jackhammer.
That's true.
That's why I lose.
See, he's got a trophy for it. Indeed, this is very true, and it's very, very cool. So, unlike that fake Cerruti Mastodon site that I've ranted out about plenty here in San Diego, this is an actual archaeological site with actual tools littered around this ancient rhino who's in one of the Philippine Islands. So, the previous oldest site in these islands is about 67,000 years old, and it's a human toe. That fits with the migration model into Australia and how they were getting there. Now, at that point, that was the earliest evidence of hominid boat travel over the ocean, was the humans that made it from kind of that area to Australia. We know that no matter what, even at the lowest point of water, they had to cross open ocean at that point. So we knew around 70,000 years ago or something like that, that we were taking boats across the ocean. That was already a big deal in and of itself.
I didn't realize Carnival Cruises was that old.
Yeah.
They were Pacific Islanders. Could it have been paddleboarders?
Yeah, it could have been. It could have been anything. It took something to get there. Now, again, this is long before Homo sapiens, 700,000 years ago. We're probably looking at a Homo erectus. It may even be the same type of Homo erectus main group that led to Homo floresiensis, the hobbit species over in Indonesia, not that far away. It could be that same group. It could be the Homo erectus that was part of the same group of Java man, some of the other stuff that we have in the Indonesia area. We know that there were hominids in this area, and now we can prove that they butchered a rhino on one of the Philippine Islands 700,000 years ago, which is a really interesting thing and a big deal. It is hard to cross the ocean. It is a big deal to have some kind of watercraft that allows you to have a stable population cross an ocean.
This was a butchery site. This wasn't just some poor Filipino driver steering his boat into a rhino.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
This was...
Now, we should mention, we covered on Science Faction before, this isn't necessarily the earliest use of boating technology. We have a similar site around the same time, maybe as old as a million years ago, in the Mediterranean on Crete, that also needed a boat to get to. Some people might speculate, oh, well, then this isn't a big deal. No, this is a huge deal, because navigating the open oceans of the South Pacific is a very, very different thing than the very calm seas of the Mediterranean. Theoretically, somebody could, in a horrible pinch, probably swim to some of those places that they were trying to get to in the Mediterranean.
I don't know,
not the case in the open ocean.
How many sirens and krakens does the goddamn Pacific have? The Mediterranean is loaded with sea beasts.
That is very true. So very neat to see that there were people running around on this island. Again, not Homo sapiens, but some ancestral species. They were butchering these rhinos. Unlike the Cerruti Mastodon site, which isn't a real site, they actually left real stone tools that we see surrounding it, like we do with all these butchery type sites. And now we can go back and try and figure out, who were these people? What other evidence did they leave? Do we have evidence of their tools in other places? Can we find their habitation zones? What can we figure out about this mysterious group that was living there? And maybe it's not even a group we know about. I mean, maybe it's not Homo erectus. Maybe it's one of the many mysterious other hominids we haven't discovered yet.
You need to have that episode where you detail your rivalry with Cerruti.
Yeah.
Just ready to reference in case you ever bring up your rivalry again, because perhaps there are people who want to be on your side, but bringing up Cerruti now just kind of seems like an inside joke.
You can go to our website and check out a blog I wrote on the Cerruti Mastodon site. Long story short, it's total BS. Speaking of BS, Ian, thank you for winning I Call BS.
I agree, that was BS that Ian won.
And thank you, audience, for coming back for Science Faction 226, where you learned about bioinformatics, HIV's pesky cousin, how a mom's coffee intake can make her kids fat, why we might get migraines because our ancestors were cold, how baking soda can treat autoimmune diseases, how we might soon have a herpes vaccine, and how humans were taking craft across the open ocean to kill rhinos 700,000 years ago. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back next week for Science Faction 227.
Yo mama's so fat that it's indicative of your grandmama's coffee habit.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.